I live in Israel. This season is dedicated to the memory of the 1,400 of my countrymen who were massacred on October 7th and the 240 people that were kidnapped and are being held hostage by the terrorist organization Hamas. Hopefully they will be returned to their families as soon as possible, and hopefully this terrible war will be able to come to a peaceful end very soon. Welcome to Minute 122 of Season 6 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we take a Capra-esque journey through the 1946 classic, It's a Wonderful Life, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Amanda from Hollywood Consumer. Welcome back to the show, Amanda.
Thanks, happy to be here.
All right, so Minute 122 begins with Bert showing up at the door and ends with George weeping for help. So yesterday we dealt with the whole fact that George had his bubble burst after believing that hopefully if Mary sees him, everything will just flood back into her mind and she'll fall in love with him again. And that just doesn't happen here. So he caused a little bit of trouble and ended up realizing that he needs Clarence's help. So before we actually get into today's minute, so Amanda, why don't you tell everyone a little bit about your background with this movie? Do you remember when you first saw it? Any other information, tidbits that you might have about that?
Yeah, so I don't remember when I first saw it, because I know that I saw it when I was very young. It's been a holiday tradition of ours. I don't quite remember when we started watching it every year, but it's my Christmas Eve movie. I have to, at the end of the day on Christmas Eve, no matter what else we've done, if we've gone out to do something Christmassy or had friends or family over or done dinner, I sit down, I put on It's a Wonderful Life, and if I have any Christmas wrapping that I need to finish off, I do it while watching it, because my philosophy is it is not, Christmas Eve is not over until I have cried at the end of It's a Wonderful Life. And it's actually very fitting that this is the minute that we're talking about this in, because it's in this particular minute, that it's my favorite moment of the film.
Oh, wow. Keep everyone in suspense. Don't tell us yet what it is.
Yeah. We'll get to it. And it's the one that always makes me cry.
Right. And that's all we have for this minute. So we'll just.
I think other than that, I've seen it a couple times. The only exceptions that I make to the Christmas Eve rule is if it's playing somewhere locally, I'll go see it. And there are a lot of theaters, especially this last year. I don't know what it was. It was like something got into all of the marketing minds at the local theaters. They decided to do a whole bunch of Christmas movies in theaters. And so there's a couple. And I think I can't remember if we went and saw it this year or if it was the year before. But I also had the opportunity to see it at the TCM Film Festival several years ago at what used to be the Grauman's Chinese Theater. I forget what it's been renamed to, but it was on the big IMAX screen.
Oh,
and
wow.
It was incredible. It was an incredible experience. So I'm also lucky enough to have seen it on the big screen a couple times. But I always say, sometimes I change my favorite Christmas movie, but the truth of the matter is I think It's a Wonderful Life is my favorite. Like I said, just because it's so much of a tradition. And I have so many warm feelings towards it.
Oh, wow. Very, very cool. Wait, so do you know approximately how many times you've seen it in the theater? I've never seen it in the theater. I haven't had that that opportunity. I don't live in an area, where I know you and your father, love to live places where you're a hop, was it a hop, step, and a jump
Hop,
from
skip, and a jump.
hop, skip, and a jump. There you
Yeah.
go. From places that you know that constantly have, I guess you can call them retro movies. You know, theaters
Yeah.
that show older movies, and that's one of the things that I miss when the fact that I'm here. But
Yeah.
I know. I guess I know in LA you guys always saw them, and even apparently even in Austin you get them. So I've never seen actually of the six movies that I've done. The only one that I've seen in the theater is Die Hard 2, which I saw twice in the theater. All the others, I never saw The Great Escape in the theater. I've never seen Planes, Trains, and Automobiles in the theater. Never seen Die Hard in the theater. Never seen
Oh.
When Harry Met Sally in the theater. Saw Die Hard 2, and then this one. But my next season, which will start in a few weeks, in 12 days, which anyone who's paying attention will know what it is, even though I'm not going to say it again. But that's another movie that I did see in the theater also. So there you go.
Yeah.
Two out of seven, I guess,
Well,
isn't so bad.
yeah.
But I only saw them. But the two that I saw when they came out. I never saw them, you know, in a retro, you know. So I'd love to see any of these now, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah. Well, of the ones you just mentioned, I've seen Die Hard in a theater and I've seen When Harry Met Sally in a theater. Actually, I have a very cool When Harry Met Sally story that was also at the TCM Film Festival, and the opening was Meg Ryan and Billy Crystal being carried out on the couch while Rob Reiner
It had to be you.
sang the no, I think it was the Oklahoma song.
Ah, okay. Oh, wow, that's pretty
so
cool.
that was a pretty cool experience. And Die Hard, you know, came out the year I was born, so I didn't see it when it was initially released,
Yeah,
but I think
well,
I've
maybe you
seen that one
did.
before.
You sure your father didn't take you to see it?
No, I think because I think it came out, I believe it came out earlier in the summer, and I was born in June, so maybe, you know,
So,
I don't know. He
in other
always.
words, your father probably went without your mother.
Oh yeah, maybe. Or they went, But but how many times I've seen It's a Wonderful Life? I would say at least three, maybe up to five times in theaters. Yeah.
Very jealous, very jealous. One of these days, one of these days. I mean, when I was in the States almost 2 years ago, I finally got to see Back to the Future again in the theater. You know, that I had seen
Oh,
when it
nice.
originally came out. I saw it two or three times in 85, and then I happened to go see it. I've told this story before, but I drove an hour and a half to be able to go see it, and I was
Wow.
really, really scared that I wasn't going to be able to get t a ticket and whatever. You know, so I got there, I think, an hour before the movie started in order to buy a ticket, and then I said, I'll just drive around or whatever it is. And I was the only person in the theater. I went on a Friday at like 12:30 in the afternoon or something like that. No, actually, I think it was even later. Maybe it was like a 2 o'clock showing or something like that. But it was great to be able to, you know, it would have been great to be in a packed theater, but you know, to be able to also see it on my own, you know, the whole theater all to myself was also great.
Yeah, no. Well, and unfortunately with It's a Wonderful Life, it's really only going to be in theaters probably around Christmas time. So that's the time you got to be traveling
For sure. For
anywhere.
sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, but there's too much snow all around for that, you know.
Yep.
And the prices of plane tickets go up at that time, you know, for
Yeah,
obvious reasons.
exactly.
So I don't know.
Maybe one
Exactly.
day.
One day, one day, one day. I can dream, you know. Back to this minute. So George basically runs out of this establishment in order to try and seek try and find Clarence, I guess. Trying, you know, I can't, you know, I won't even say he's trying to seek salvation. He's trying to, you know, find you know, and as soon as he comes out and goes, Clarence, and Bert is on his way into this establishment at the time, and Bert is, you know, running along. You know, trying to get in there as quickly as possible. And he goes, "Right, that's you." And George just looks at him and just punches him in the face.
Yes. I will say the punching thing, So I just watched a whole bunch of Jimmy Stewart movies yesterday in preparation for this, and that is a theme within his movies. So,
where that he punches someone like that?
That he punches, yeah. I mean, in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, he punches all the reporters that wrote about him. The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, he punches John Wayne. I think in The Man Who Knew Too Much, I think he punches somebody here or there. Oh yeah, because he punches the assassin. It's not a thing that I like realized was a Jimmy Stewart sort of thing, but
oh wow,
he likes to punch people in his movies, or his directors like to have him punch people.
So it's like Tom Hanks has to like pee in his movie, and therefore yeah. You know, so if you make a list, you'd say that okay, Jimmy Stewart needs to punch people, and Tom Hanks needs to pee in his movies. I remember years ago, I read an article that someone wrote, that a friend of mine had written, about how just about in every single Tom Hanks movie up until that point, there is some scene that deals with peeing. You know, like in A League of Their Own, you know, he goes to the bathroom right there in the dugout. Forrest Gump, the whole thing with drinking the Dr. Peppers. Mm-hmm. In Castaway, he's constantly finding places to go that he needs to go. In The Green Mile, he has an infection and has trouble going. You know, and the list goes on and on.
It's a thing.
It really is.
Well, it's like Brad Pitt eating in movies.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Makes sense. Yeah. And, I mean, it's great how... You know, he just punches him and just runs off.
Yes.
And then Bert does one of the craziest things that happens in this movie that to this day I still don't understand. You know, it makes absolutely no sense. He screams, "Stand back!" And then he draws his gun and shoots at George. He shoots in George's direction where there are other people, you know, standing around also. I mean, it really is a miracle that he didn't hit anybody by shooting that, as far as we know. Did you count how many shots he takes?
No, I didn't. I was too busy kind of being surprised. You know, he's running off. He's not armed. So it seems a pretty aggressive move, you know.
Right. Well, he did just punch him in the face after being bitten in the hand also. So, you know, I guess he's a little agitated, but again, it doesn't warrant, maybe in Powder Hill you're allowed to.
Or maybe they're the rubber bullets. Maybe that's it. You know, it's just going to take him down, but not
seriously. I don't think so. So, I mean, he has a revolver and he takes 6 shots, which means that at this point, Bert has no more bullets left in his gun.
Yeah. he empties it
but again, it's just really funny because if you look, you'll see that George is running around, he's like near other people, and you see a few mm-hmm. people like jump to the ground in order to avoid getting hit by any of these stray bullets from Bert. You know, I think it's
all the people that drop. Yeah,
that's right. I think it's a little bit reckless. Slightly.
Just a little bit.
Slightly.
Yeah.
You know. And what's great is as you see George run, you see in the distance, you know, a neon sight that should say Pottersville, but it actually just says Potter LLE.
Oh.
Okay. So the question is, you know, did Bert hit one of those and make it? Actually, he does. You see Pottersville at 10 seconds, you see Pottersville. And then as George is running past it, you see three letters just go out. You have the S, V, and I.
So that's where the 3 of the 6 bullets went.
Well, no, maybe it's a magic bullet theory. You know, it's the same bullet that hit. So in other words, Bert is a pretty good shot, at being able to hit what he's not aiming at.
Yeah.
Wow, I never noticed that before. The flashy Pottersville neon sign, which looks like it's actually in front of the library,
mm-hmm.
just
oh yeah,
blanks out. You know, and we can see a few other stores that are here that we hadn't seen earlier, because they, up until now we've only seen things that have neon lights, but we can see that there's a cafe and there's a grocery store. It says something grocers. Can't really read what the top name of that is, but it gives more of a flavor to downtown Pottersville. That it's not only open at night.
There is a daytime to this world.
That's right. Even though, I mean, we do see that Mary is, leaving work relatively late. I mean, we don't know exactly what time it is, but the assumption is it's pretty late.
Well, and also it is winter, so it is darker earlier. So it could very well be that the library closed at 4 and it's already dark, because that's
Okay,
what
well,
happens.
I did check, and I don't remember right now what the answer was, but I did check when sunset was in 1945, on December 24th, 1945, in like Rochester, and it was like around 5 o'clock or something like that. But when George was in his house, we saw that it was already, I think, like 6:45 or something like that, and then he went out and got a little drunk, and then he was wandering around with Clarence, and my assumption is this is already like 10, 11 o'clock at night, maybe 10 o'clock, maybe 10 o'clock, which means that
Which
it's
makes
really
me,
late to close the library.
I was gonna say that makes me question the previous minute where we're gone. She's closing up the library. It's Christmas Eve. She's closing at like 11 o'clock at night. That seems really late.
Well, again, she's got nothing to go home to.
That's true.
And if you look at it from that perspective, you can say that she was just catching up on some paperwork. I don't know.
There you go.
Maybe that's the answer to it. I don't know. And George just keeps running. Goes back to what we were talking about with Tom Hanks. So here he's just running. He's doing his Forrest Gump impression. And then we see Bert jump into the car really quickly and drive off after George. And I love it. It's great. One of the guys who jumped to the ground when he was shooting is right near the police car. And as Bert is driving, he is very close to hitting this guy, but just, the guy was able to scamper away because he's still crouched down.
Bert's not necessarily paying close attention to his surroundings.
No, not at all. And then the scene changes, and we're back at the famous bridge. George is running towards the bridge, and he keeps calling out. He goes, "Clarence, Clarence, 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 help me, Clarence." And we can hear sirens in the background. And he goes, "Get me back. Get me back. I don't care what happens to me. Get me back to my wife and kids. Help me, Clarence. Please. Please. I want to live again. I want to live again." And then he says a third time, "I want to live again." I guess maybe it's, there's no place like home that you have to say it three times.
Three times. It's like click your heels three times and you're home.
That's right. And then he changes and says, "Please God, let me live again." So I think maybe the maybe he wasn't supposed to be asking Clarence, he was supposed to be asking God.
Well, so and this, by the way, is my favorite moment of the movie. The final breakdown and the way that his voice breaks when he says, "Please God, I want to live again." I don't know if you noticed, but that's when the snow starts to fall again.
Yes, that's exactly when the snow starts falling. Even though it's very interesting, right beforehand, we see the police car pull up. So the question is this the good Bert or the evil Bert who's pulling up?
When the
Like at what stage does it revert back to the real universe? Is it only when he asks God for help and then the snow starts? Or
That's what I think.
yes, but we also go to the fact that and we talked about this a few weeks ago. How did George not being around change the fact that whether it's snowing or not?
Well, I don't know if what the theory was. My theory is that there's some sort of, you know, suspended time thing that's happening, and or the multiverse, you know, in this particular multiverse, it's just a different enough that that the weather is slightly different too. But it's whatever the logical, you know, actual explanation is. It's a visual sort of cue for everybody watching the movie to know.
Yeah, so of course.
It's a creative choice.
Oh, no, I completely agree with it. I mean, it's not, you know, there are so many questions that can be asked about movies that we will never have the answer to. You know, it's just, right. It's just a guess, and we can have as many theories as we want, you know, and there's no way to prove most of these theories if they're right or if they're wrong. You know, it doesn't make a difference. You know, like I've mentioned this numerous times that you know, how does Mr. Potter get up to the second floor of the building alone?
Oh, yeah.
Because we never see that there's an elevator there. So my theory is that Potter is not really handicapped, and that he's faking it to get more sympathy.
That could be. He could also be making his bodyguard carry him.
Yeah. Exactly. Could be either of those. Those are the two main options that we've thought of, you know, over the course of 122 episodes. You know, maybe I should have asked every guest, what do they think?
Is he really?
You know, take a poll. You know, I mean, one of the things that I have asked almost a lot of the guests is who do you think is more of a villain, Mr. Potter or Hans Gruber?
Well,
like, who's more evil?
Well, I think I'm gonna have probably say I think Potter's more evil, but Hans is more calculating. Maybe.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, they're both. The deal is, I think they're both willing to. I don't know that Potter is necessarily willing to kill to get his way. Hans is willing to kill to get his way. But what Potter does to people is he destroys their lives, and to a point where they may, you know, they may end up doing the deed themselves. And so in some ways, I think that's worse because he finds joy in it. He finds joy in making other people miserable. Whereas Hans is very much, he just wants to get the job done. He wants to stick to his plan, and he is not necessarily getting enjoyment from the suffering of the people that are impacted by his plan. He doesn't until John McClane gets in his way, and then he finds enjoyment in some of the torturous things that he does.
Yes. Okay. That is definitely a fair assessment of of that. Like you said, we see the police car in the background, and George has finally realized the important things in life, and it's not the $8,000. That's what it basically comes down to, which I guess is why this is one of your favorite moments in the movie, if not the favorite moment in the movie.
Yes, I'm sure. I was gonna say, I'm sure it's a lot of people love this moment because it's what the movie's all about. It's he not only has he gone through in the last, I mean, obviously in the previous 2 hours, but also just within the last couple of minutes, having that realization of not only the impact that he has had on other people's lives, but the impact that people have had on his life, in particular Mary, and that he doesn't want to live a life without that. And everything else will be figured out in some way or another. And it's not worth throwing your life away or wishing away your existence if you don't have the people you love in your life,
right.
And they don't have you. So
exactly. I think you summed that up really well.
Thank you.
And I hope you're not. I hope you're able to keep those tears back.
just a little bit.
Well, okay, no, because you said every time you see the scene, you start crying, and you know, I don't know how many times you had to watch it when you were doing your preparation.
Oh well, when I was doing the preparation, definitely got a little teary-eyed. It's not doesn't necessarily have as big an impact if you're watching it sort of in a silo, but it still does pull on those heartstrings a little bit, and
Right.
suddenly you're blinking a little bit more.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. And that's basically how this minute ends. I think it's a nice place for it to end.
Yeah.
To keep people in suspense, to find out what's gonna happen tomorrow. You see the police car in the background, you see George pleading, what's gonna happen? What's gonna happen? So I don't have anything else for this minute. Do you have anything else?
No, I think we covered it pretty nicely. Like I said, it's so funny because it's so close to the end of the movie, but I have to get it in every Christmas Eve. It has to be I have to watch and get the emotional build up to it. And it's very cathartic. It's one of the things that I love about the movie. It's one of the things I love about the season, that there's sort of this like melancholy mixed with lots of joy and cheer. Like I said, it's just I love Jimmy Stewart, especially in this particular moment. I think, I'm a big fan of his. I think he's great in everything that I've seen him in. But in this particular, like I said, the fact that he's acting and it's his voice that gets that emotion through, because his head is down, and he's got a little bit of the body language going, but it's really his voice that sells it.
It's very believable. There's absolutely no
Yes.
question about that.
Yes.
All right, great. So every Friday we have a segment called Oscar Oops, where the idea is that over the last 96 years of the Oscars, there have been a lot of ups and downs, things that people agree with, things that people don't agree with. And so what I decided to do was see what five Best Picture winners, my guests believe, were not the right choice, and which five movies should have beaten those that were obviously nominated those years. So what have you got for us, Amanda?
Yes. So I do have five movies. I have most of them are from the last decade, 'cause that's probably the time period I'm the most familiar with.
That's allowed.
I've pretty much since 2000, I'd say, watched all of the Best Picture nominees. I've missed a couple here or there. So I
Shame,
wanted to
shame,
make
shame.
sure I wanted to make sure that I had chosen films that where I'd actually seen the movie that I thought should have won and the movie that won, as opposed to just saying, I had my favorite movie for that year. So the first one I want to talk about is the 2014 film that didn't win in 2015. It's always a little bit weird because it's technically the year
Right.
before. Film that won was Birdman,
That's
and
right.
the film that I think should have won was Whiplash. That movie is tense from start to finish, and it's a movie about jazz. I mean, it should not be as tense as it is, but J.K. Simmons is incredible in it. Miles Teller, it is Miles Teller. Yes, it's Miles Teller. Is it incredibly impressive, and their dynamic is so good, and it's just I do not have anything really against Birdman. I don't think that it's a great film. I don't think that it's as good as people say it is. I do like Michael Keaton. But I don't think that it's one of those ones that I think that the Academy loves to shower praise on. It's kind of weird. It's got, an older actor in it that kind of was making a comeback, sort of. And Whiplash was that was Damien Chazelle's sort of first real feature. It was a young director. They probably didn't, there's some politics, I think, at the Academy. But Whiplash is a much better film, and it's a much better story, I think, too. So that's my first one.
Okay.
My second one, and I didn't know if you had anything you want, if you had any thoughts on either of them.
Well, I don't want to give away. People are going to have to wait another 11 days to find out what my movies are. But I enjoyed both of those movies. I think Birdman I enjoyed more when I first saw it. You know, the gimmick of Birdman is something that doesn't you know, I don't think it stands the test of time. You know, again, I'm not saying whether that's on my list or not, but I mean, Whiplash. My problem with Whiplash is that also I find it to be a really intense and a good movie. But do I think that it was Best Picture worthy? Probably not. But you know,
which is fair. I think you kind of said it. One of my thoughts about Birdman is I don't think it has much repeatability.
Correct.
It's kind of fun and funky when you're watching it, and then it just doesn't really work the next time around.
It probably worked like two or three times, but that's it. You know.
Whereas I feel like Whiplash, it's great performances every time you see it, so there's always that bit of intensity that comes with it.
Yeah.
Okay. The second year that I want to talk about is 2016. But I'm not going to talk about the film that I think people think I would talk about. The film that won was Moonlight and not La La Land. And while I love La La Land, I think the movie that should have won that year is Hell or High Water. I'm a huge Taylor Sheridan fan, although it's so funny because I have not actually watched Yellowstone. But I believe I've seen all of his features. And this one in particular, maybe I'm a little biased because it takes place in Texas.
I was gonna say, I think that you recognize like where the movie is taking place.
Yeah, well, but see, this is the
thing. Like I've been to that bank.
I thought this way before I moved. This movie came out before I moved to Texas, and I felt that it was the best movie of the year, even before then, before I had moved. But no, I just, you know, I think it's a very, I feel like a very kind of me type of film. It's about two brothers. It's sort of, you know, an everyman versus the law, and there's heists and chases. And I think there was a set of his of Taylor Sheridan films that he calls like his frontier westerns or something, or modern frontier westerns, and this is one of them. And I think it's just a really good script. I think it's an incredible performance by Ben Foster, and then, you know, Jeff Bridges and Chris Pine are also great. But I just, again, it's Moonlight is a perfectly fine film. I think it's a little dry at times, and it's very, you know, it's got the three separate acts, and so it's very kind of stiff in that way. The performances in that are good as well, but I just think that, again, Hell or High Water is a better story from start to finish, both in the way that it's told and the acting and the way that it's shot. So,
okay.
Yeah. The next movie that I want to talk about is from 2019, and it's kind of interesting that we talked about the Birdman issue because the movie that won in 2019 was Parasite, which is another one that I think is a perfectly fine film. I know a lot of people love it. I think it's a little overhyped. But I don't have anything against it. You know, I didn't hate it, but 1917 was it just an incredibly impressive film, both from the technical standpoint and the performances and the story itself. So, you know, it's another one of those one track kind of films where it's all supposed to be seamless. It's all supposed to take place within those exact 2 hours, or, you know, there's a little bit of a time jump.
Yeah.
But the way that it's shot and the way that it's edited together is just really impressive. And it's another one of those ones that builds tension really effectively throughout. And I'm also, you know, I'm a sucker for a good World War One or World War Two film. I think there is an inherent, you know, emotion that comes with those films. And so I think that there's a little bit of that that definitely gets played on in this, but I think it does so in a very sensitive and sort of honorary way. I mean, obviously Sam Mendes, you know, dedicates the film to his grandfather and, yes, and all of the soldiers that fought during the war. But it's like I said, and I forget the main actor's name, but he has to carry a whole film essentially by himself, and it's just very, very effective. And I think every time I watch it, I still get tense. I still get, you know, really emotional at the end as he's running across the field as bombs are going off.
Mm-hmm.
So like I said, that compared to Parasite, which like I said, is a very fine film, but I didn't get the emotional movement from Parasite. So I'm always a little bit bitter when I think of that year.
Yeah, it's actually funny because as we, you know, as I said about Birdman, that's something that because of the gimmick doesn't work so well over the long run. I think, like you said, 1917 works even better the more and more you watch it.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I actually got to see that in IMAX, and it was just unbelievable seeing it second time in IMAX.
Yeah. So I saw it in IMAX a couple times. I actually went, I went to go see the Birds of Prey movie, which was a thing. That's a whole separate thing. They had an issue, and I was at a theater that was not going to be convenient to like come back to later, but they were willing to give me a ticket for a later show. And then they said, if you want, you can go see something else. And I said, well, 1917 is starting, so I'll go see it. I think I saw it three times in theaters. And I do think, to your point, I think with Birdman, they make it a gimmick as opposed to actually being sort of a part of how they want to tell the story. Like it kind of, with 1917, the one track thing makes a little bit more sense because it ties into all of this like timing and the, you know, rough terrain that they have to go across. And mm-hmm. it's a way to visually tell that.
Right.
Yeah.
Very
cool. So my fourth film is another war movie. It's from 2017, Dunkirk, and the movie that beat it out was The Shape of Water, which I really do not like. Again, I know a lot of people like it. I keep trying to be
apparently everyone who voted in the you know the majority of people who voted you know for the Oscars.
yes, which I have found that I don't typically agree with them,
right.
But I will say I have tried to become a Guillermo del Toro fan, and I have not been super impressed with anything of his that I've seen, which is just very odd because he's a, you know, kind of a dark horror themed director. Horror is my favorite genre, and The Shape of Water is definitely not. There are some horror elements to it, but it's not a horror film. And it's weird. It's just a weird film. I didn't like it. Some of the visuals are impressive. But again, Dunkirk. It's another one that's, you know, the way that it's shot, the way that it's edited, the story that it tells, and the performances all are impressive and all are well executed.
Mm-hmm.
Some people complain a little bit about the time thing, you know, that it's not very clear what exactly is going on. And I can kind of see that point that, you know, it's a little confusing. I think that there are some specific visuals that happen to kind of showcase the differences in the timeline of each story. But it's just, again, if we're talking about the best picture of the year, the thing that was not only maybe the best story, but like kind of the best elements of filmmaking all in one, plus it's, you know, largely appealing to mass audiences, Dunkirk is the better film of that year. And I would argue probably the one that more people have seen since. I don't know that many people go back to The Shape of Water, or many people that didn't see it when it first came out have sought it out. Whereas Dunkirk is one of those ones that people go, oh yeah, that's one that I want to see that I didn't get a chance to see, so I'll see it now.
Right.
And of course, like I said, it's a World War II film, so it kind of has that, you know, emotional, and it's also a true story. You know, it's based on true events, I should say.
Right.
It's not necessarily a true story. So there's also a little bit of that element. And then the last film, I don't think anybody's going to be surprised that knows me. 1975, Jaws was beaten by One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which, again, I love One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. I haven't seen it in years, but I know it's an incredible film. Incredible performances, but I think when people look back, there's a very different type of film, and I don't think that it, again, if we go back to, you're talking about the best picture of the year, the best story, the best acting, the best technical feat, the most maybe culturally impactful, Jaws is the clear winner. I obviously think that Jaws is the greatest movie ever made.
I wonder why.
Other people can argue with me, but
you've
seen
it since you came out of the womb. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I think it was pretty much inevitable that was going to be my favorite movie.
Surprisingly, there's one other guest that chose that as their number one.
Yeah. Well, it was funny because I was talking to that guest. And I think that we have some pretty similar lists. I think that 1917 and Dunkirk might have been on those lists as well.
Yes, they both were.
Yeah.
They were further down in the list, but yes, they were both on the list.
Yeah. Yes. So, I think...
Your father also chose Raiders of the Lost Ark and The Right Stuff. Those are the other two.
Well, which are also both excellent, excellent movies.
Yeah.
And yeah, I do think that with Jaws, as with a couple of the others on this list, the culture has kind of course corrected and said, this is the thing that we are going to accept into our culture and as part of, you know, what defines our entertainment. So in the grand scheme of things, does the fact that it didn't win really mean that much in the long run? Probably not, except it's still a little, you know, bitter source
right.
of pain for me.
Completely understandable. All right, great. So, Amanda, would you like to once again tell people where they can find you?
Yes, they can find me on hollywoodconsumer.wordpress.com or at @Hollywood_consumer on Instagram.
All right. Excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. And you can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. So, until tomorrow, hot dog.
Hot dog.
I love you truly, truly dear. Life with its sorrow, life with its tears.